Hello, this is Professor Tufano, and I will be talking about Chapter 5 on Language, and this is in the 13th edition of the Interplay textbook for interpersonal communication. It begins on page 139 and ends on page 167, and then you have the review pages and at the back of that chapter. So let me give you an outline of the chapter. It says the nature of language. It says the impact of language, gender in language, and social media in language. So that's going to be the highlight. So under the nature of language, we have language is symbolic, it's rule governed, it's subjective, and language and worldview. Under the impact of language, we have naming and identity, affiliation, power and politeness, precision and vagueness, the language of responsibility. Under gender and language, we have the extent of gender differences, accounting for gender differences. And then lastly, we have social media and language, online language and impression management, and then gender and online language. Okay, so beginning on page 140, it says here that language is symbolic. So the nature of language. Language is symbolic. So what in the world does it mean that language is symbolic? It says words are arbitrary symbols that have no meaning in and of themselves. For example, the word five is a kind of code that represents the number of fingers on your hand, only because we agree that it does. According to some researchers, it says there is nothing particular five-like in the number five. So they use the example in the speech, this French speaker uses a different symbol that has the same meaning as five. So even sign language is spoken by deaf people is symbolic in nature and not pantomime as it may seem. Because this form of communication is symbolic and not literal, there are hundreds of different sign languages used around the world that have evolved independently, whether significant numbers of deaf people have come in contact or not. So they list a couple of different languages. So symbols. So what is a symbol? So the letter of an alphabet is a symbol. So when you take the letters of an alphabet, those are symbols. And you put those symbols in a certain order. And in this case, if we're still sticking with the idea of the word five, then we have an F, an I, and a V, and an E in that order. And if that word is in a sentence, it's normally there will be a space between that word and, of course, the word that is after the word five. So language is symbolic. So words are arbitrary symbols. So each letter is a symbol, and when they are put in a certain order, we will recognize them as a word, especially if we're talking about the 26 letters of the English alphabet, and we're speaking about English, then we know that word five, and we generally have an understanding of the meaning of that five, but independent of the context, some words obviously would be much more easy to define, have less variances than if they were in context. So I said if I had five toes or five fingers or I was a five-headed monster, maybe one would be literal and I hope that the other would be figurative use of the word five. So language is symbolic. The letters are symbols. Words then are a specific arrangement of individual symbols, and words definitely are symbols, basically individual symbols put in a certain order. Moving on to languages rule governed, the only reason symbol-laden languages work at all is that the people agree on how to use them. These linguistic agreements, they make communication possible because they're codified in rules. So we have a couple of different rules here. Phonetical rules. We have semantic rules. So let's talk about, and syntactic rules. Sorry, the three. Phonological. Phonological governs how sounds are combined to form words. Many of you learned phonics. Maybe you had the video back in the day, or the disc back in the day. Hooked on Phonics was very popular when my children were learning. Well, maybe not initially. It could have been a little bit later in their growth. But phonics, the sounds that the letters make, and we combined the sounds to make words. Of course, it doesn't always work, but it is a pretty good rule that if you could know the sound the letter makes and you combine those sounds, you may be able to form some words or phrases. And of course, multiple words would form sentences. But they use a couple of different words like champagne or double or occasion that it says here they have the same meaning in French and English, but they're pronounced differently because the languages have different phonetic rules. So champagne or double or occasion, even though they are spelled the same, if they're spoken in English or French, they would sound different because they have different phonological rules. That's a tongue twister. Phonics, phonological rules. I guess if you could say it, phonological. No, okay, let's go with that. Let's go with the phonological, maybe easier to say. And that determines the spoken language sounds. However, syntactical rules, they govern the way symbols can be arranged, syntactical. Notice that the following statements contain the same words, but the shift in syntax creates quite a different meaning. So here are the two sentences on page 141. First, whiskey makes you sick when you're well. Whiskey makes you sick when you're well. Okay, it's interesting. I don't know. I imagine it may help you feel better. I don't know. Okay. The second sentence has an abbreviation in there. So whiskey, there's a comma. When you're sick, comma, makes you well. So whiskey makes you sick when you're well, the first sentence. So if you're not sick and you drink whiskey, it makes you sick. But adding the punctuation, which is part of the syntactical rules in that sentence, whiskey, comma, when you're sick, comma, makes you well. I know it's a silly example, but so we've talked about the phonological rules and the syntactical rules. And then we have semantical rules, semantics. Semantic rules also govern our use of language. When syntax deals with structure, semantics governs the meaning of statements. Semantic rules are what makes it possible for us to agree that bikes are for riding and books are for reading. They help us know whom we will encounter when we use restrooms marked men or women. Without semantical rules, communication would be impossible. Each of us would use symbols in a unique way, unintelligible to others. Semantic rules help us understand the meaning of individual words, but they often don't explain how language operates in everyday life. Consider the following statement. Let's get together! This semantic meaning of this word, of these, this word, those words, are pretty clear. Yet, the statement could be interpreted several ways. For instance, it could be a request, I hope we get together. It could be a polite command, I want to get together. Or it could be an empty cliche, I don't really mean it, but I'm just saying it. So it says, we learn to distinguish the accurate meaning of such speech acts through pragmatic rules. Another rule. Pragmatic rules tell us what uses and interpretations of a message are appropriate within a given context. So to recap, we have pragmatic rules, we have semantic rules, we have syntactic rules, and then we have phonological rules. That is the nature of language being symbolic. Page 143, language is subjective. And please refer to Ogden's and Richard's triangle of meaning. At the top of this triangle, you have a thought or reference. At the bottom right, you have a referent. And then you have a symbol on the bottom left corner. And they use a pretty good example of a thought or reference of a furry dog. Say a dog. And in the left corner would be D-O-G. And then in that right corner, the referent would be, in your mind, a picture of a dog. It says, if the rules of language were more precise and if everyone followed them, we would suffer from fewer misunderstandings. You can have an hour-long argument about feminism only to discover that you were using the term in different ways and that you really were in basic agreement. So it says here, the problem occurs when people attach different meanings to the same message. Ogden and Richards illustrated this point in their well-known triangle of meaning. This model shows that there's only an indirect relationship indicated by the broken line between a word and a thing or an idea that it represents. It says the Ogden and Richard model is an oversimplification in that not all words refer to physical things or references. For instance, abstract ideas such as love or anger, they probably wouldn't fit this. But it clearly demonstrates an important principle. And I would take some mental notes or physical notes here. It says here, and it definitely demonstrates, it clearly demonstrates an important principle. Meanings are in people and not words. Meanings are in people, not words. Hence, an important task facing communicators is to establish a common understanding of the words they use to exchange messages. So, as I've mentioned earlier, that communication and relationships, there is compromise, there's accommodation, there's negotiation, there's another C, collaboration, and then we have expectations, and then we have boundaries. So if you can refer back to those ideas as you're trying to develop and maintain relationships, especially the romantic, intimate type, you will have to compromise with a partner. You'll have to collaborate with a partner. You'll have to accommodate with a partner, right? You'll have to negotiate with a partner. You will have to discuss boundaries, yours, theirs, and then you will also have to deal with expectations about how a relationship should proceed, expectations about what is appropriate. So if you're taking notes, that would be very helpful if you're trying to develop deep intimacy with a romantic partner, especially if you're looking for something that is exclusive and that would be long-term. Those are very important ideas of communication. Okay, page 145, it says the impact of language, naming and identity, affiliation, power and politeness. And what else do I want to cover? Precision and vagueness. Abstraction. Euphemisms. Relative language. Static evaluation. Okay, good. So, on page 145, we talk about the impact of language. It says, as linguistic relativity suggests, and to define linguistic relativity, it says here, a language both reflects and shapes the worldview of those who use it. That a language both reflects and shapes the worldview of those who use it. So, getting back to that concept, as linguistic relativity suggests, language can have a strong influence on our perception and how we regard one another. So, naming and identity. It says here, Juliet asks rhetorically to Romeo, what's in a name? It says, if Romeo had been a social scientist, he would have answered a great deal. Research has demonstrated that names are important, not just a simple identification. They shape the way others think of us, the way we view ourselves, and the way we act. So, what does your name say about you? Does your name shape when people find out about your name? Does it shape the way they think of you? Does your name shape the way that you view yourself? And does your name shape the way that you act? So this is, I think, a bit controversial and regarding those three questions. But let's see what the authors have to say here. It says, for more than a century, researchers have studied the impact of rare and unusual names of people who bear them. So I guess we'd have to determine what is rare and what is unusual. And so in every culture, you'll find, I would say every epoch, not necessarily culture. If we talk about the United States, what was the most popular boy's name in 1950? What was the most popular girl's name in 1950? And then we can say in 1960, in 1970, in 1980, and then you could do that going forward. And what influences do they have? I'm definitely aware of Disney having influences because I have had a lot of Ariels in my class at a certain period of time when the Disney movie happened to be popular and the character was named Ariel. So as mothers, fathers are thinking about names for their children and they choose a name or they're considering a name, what drives them? What motivates them? What is their greatest concern? Is it passing something down about their culture, ethnicity, their family? Is it something making a statement? Those kind of things. So it is kind of interesting, but this idea about naming names and identity is a bit controversial. So of course, what makes a name and its spelling unusual changes over time. In 1900, the 20 most popular names for girls included Bertha, Mildred, and Ethel. By 2012, the top 20 names included Madison, Mia, and Sophia. Some people regard unique names as distinctive rather than unusual. You could probably think of four or five unique names of celebrities, sports stars, or even personal friends that make the person easily recognizable and memorable. So it is a bit controversial, but you can see, even ask yourself these questions about your own name or maybe the names of other family members or friends. And sometimes people will tell me they don't like their name. Some people like their name. Some people despise their name. Some people change their name. They don't like it. It creates them some type of problem that they want to change it. Okay, 147. Affiliation. Language could be a way of building and demonstrating solidarity with others. In one study, the likelihood of mutual romantic interest increased when conversational partners used pronouns, articles, conjunctions, prepositions, and negations matched. The same study revealed that when couples used similar language styles while doing instant messages, the chance of their relationship continuing improved by more than 50%. These researchers speculate that the unconscious language style matching relates to how much each is paying attention to what the other is saying. That's an interesting variable. How much do you pay attention to the other person? Close friends and lovers often develop a set of special terms that serve a way of signifying their relationship. So what are yours? What do you call your sweetheart, your honey? What do you call that special romantic person? I guess a pet name is another way to kind of describe that. Using the same vocabulary serves to set these people apart from others, reminding themselves and the rest of the world of their relationship. Communication researchers call the process of adapting one's speech style to match that of others with whom the communicator wants to identify is called convergence. So if the communicator wants to identify with the other person, the process of adapting to their speech style is called convergence. And then there is another style, which is the reverse or inverse of that. Communicators who want to set themselves apart from the other adapt a strategy of divergence, speaking in a way that emphasizes their differences. Sometimes college teachers do it. And again, some of this may be unconscious in a sense that they may these ideas about wanting to identify with the other communicator or wanting to disassociate from that other individual as either convergence or divergence, it may not be recognizable, like totally conscious. Could be something that just becomes a habit. But it could come across as maybe talking down, especially if you're talking about divergence to the other party. All right, on page 148, we have politeness and power. Communication researchers have identified a number of language patterns that communicate more or less power. Patterns of communication that communicate more or less power. So in order for this to be helpful, we need to have a baseline. Because if something is more or less, then we need to know what the best amount of power is. So apparently there are some language patterns that communicate more power, some that communicate less power, and there's some that communicate the proper or right amount of power. So we'll have to figure out what that is if we're going to understand this. It says, note the difference between these two statements from an employee to a manager. So an employee is normally in the hierarchy lower than the manager. The manager is normally higher in the hierarchy to the employee. You have subordinate relationships there. So here's the employee. Excuse me, sir, I hate to say this, but I guess I won't be able to finish the project on time. I had a personal emergency and, it was just impossible to finish it by today. I'll have to start it for you first thing on Monday, okay? So then here is the second way that this was communicated. I won't be able to finish the project on time. I had a personal emergency and it was impossible to finish it by today. I will have it to you first thing on Monday. So then the question here, or at least the assumption, is that one is more powerful than the other. One is less powerful than the other. It says here, the first statement is an example of powerless language. The second is powerful. So which do you prefer? So again, it's an interesting idea in regards to how power is defined in these kinds of relationships. If this was peer-to-peer, there may be some sense of one is more effective and the other is less effective, but in the context of an employer and employee, it may be that it has nothing to do with powerless or powerful. It just may be within the subordinate relationship that may be the best or most effective way to communicate failure to complete an assignment. Okay, it says here that some scholars question the label of powerless because tentative and indirect speech styles can sometimes achieve goals, and I said effective, same thing, better than more assertive approaches. So, for example, less forceful approaches can be attempts at politeness. Politeness is defined here as communicating ways that save face for both senders and receivers. Yeah, maybe makes sense. Saving face for both senders and receivers. That may be an excellent goal for communication. All right, we're skipping over to page 153. Precision and vagueness. Most people assume the goal of language is to make our ideas clear to one another. I don't know for most people, but certainly that seems to be a pretty basic goal of language, is to be clear in our communication one to another. When clarity is the goal, we need language skills to make our ideas understandable. Sometimes, however, we want to be less perfectly clear, and so they give you some ideas to consider. Ambiguous language, or ambiguity. Ambiguous language consists of words and phrases that have more than one commonly accepted definition. Some ambiguous language is amusing, as the following newspaper illustrates. So imagine this was a newspaper article. It says, police begin campaign to run down jaywalkers. The next one, teacher strikes idle kids. And then the next one, 20-year friendships ends at the altar. So those are amusing anecdotes from newspaper headlines that illustrate the idea of ambiguous language. Maybe they do. And then on page 154, they have a text message. Dad says to a child, imagine it's a son or daughter, text mom wants you to get her Prego. Prego. P-R-E-G-O. Well, I can't. I had that problem solved years ago. Oh my God, Dad. Ew, TMI. I'll forever be grossed out. Mom wants you to get her Prego. Imagine that's maybe sauce, the cooking thing. And then I guess the dad says, okay, sweetie. Okay, so it's kind of a crude way to understand this idea of ambiguous language, but it is kind of funny, I guess. So they talk about on page 154, abstractions. Abstractions are convenient ways of generalizing about similarities between several objects, people, ideas, or events. And then on page 155, they give you an example of an abstraction ladder. It says here, a boss gives feedback to an employee about career advancement at various levels of specificity. At the top, you need to have a better attitude. All right. What does that mean? You need to be more positive. What does that mean? You need to complain less. Okay, what does that mean? You need to complain less about working hard. Okay, so to be specific, you need to quit complaining every time we have to work late or come in on weekends. All right, so there's a good example, I think, of an abstraction and how we use abstractions, because we often talk in generalities, and that is oftentimes the type of language we use when it says we're talking about similarities between several objects, people, ideas, or events. Although vagueness does have its uses, highly abstract language can cause several types of problems. At the most basic level, the vagueness of some abstract language makes it hard to understand the meaning of the message. Telling a hairstylist not too short or more casual might produce the look you want, or it may lead to an unpleasant surprise. Overly abstract language could also lead to stereotyping. You may assume that abstract statements will soften the blow for all critical messages, but research suggests not always the case. People who use vague language to describe others' negative actions are rated as less likable than those who use concrete language. It seems a person describing another's negative behavior in abstract terms is assumed to have a hidden agenda. I guess instead of just being direct about it, they're being so indirect that the receiver of that information assumes the worst motive, which means they have some other agenda that they're not actually telling you about, hidden. Okay. On page 156, table 5.2, abstract and behavioral descriptions. This is a really good chart. It lists problem, goal, appreciation, complaint, request. And then at the top it says abstract description, who's involved in what circumstances, specific behaviors, and remarks. And it's interesting, so take a look at that if you would. Okay, I'm going to, we'll talk about euphemisms, and relative language, and then we'll take a break, and this will be, we'll break this up into two parts. Okay, a euphemism. Euphemism, it's a Greek word meaning to use words of good omen, or innocuous terms substituted for blunt ones. A euphemism avoids a direct literal reference to an event, such as she died. Substituting terms like she's no longer with us, she took her last breath, she jumped the last hurdle, she's gone to the, you know, big house, she's gone to the spirit in the sky. Or other more other associations of abstractions. Euphemisms are typically used to soften the impact of information that may be unpleasant, both for the person communicating and the other person receiving it. It's easy to imagine how a relational breakup may be easier to handle with the explanation, I'm not ready for a commitment, rather than, I really want to date other people. So we tend to use euphemisms more when talking with people of higher status. A way to avoid offending them. Next, we have relative language. Relative language gains meaning by comparison. For example, do you attend a large or small school? That depends on what you compare it to. Alongside the campus, such as Ohio State, which has probably about 60, 70,000 students, your school could look small. But compared with a smaller institution, maybe quite large. Relative words such as fast and slow, smart or stupid, short or long, are clearly defined only through comparisons. Using relative terms without explaining them could lead to communication problems. Have you ever responded to someone's question about the weather by saying it was warm only to find out that the other person thought it was cold? Have you followed a friend's advice and gone to a cheap restaurant only to find it was twice as expensive as what you expected? Have you ever gone to a class that was considered easy but turned out to be hard? Probably not. But the problem is that each case resulted from failing to link the relative word to a more measurable term. So you need to find some type of measurement to compare it to. So easy, hard, cheap, expensive, small or large, we need to compare it as compared to. And sometimes that's all you have to say, as compared to. Citrus College is small. Norco College is small, Riverside Community College is small, as compared to, and then you just come up with some other school that's larger. Norco is larger than another community college, and so you could do Citrus is small, Citrus is large, so it just really depends. Cal Baptist is large compared to APU. APU is small as compared to, I don't know, just fill in the blank, but you do have to have some type of measurement that you could compare it to for it to make more sense. Okay, so we'll stop here for part one of chapter five on language, and then we'll pick up on for part two. So this will be at least two parts for chapter five. Okay, Professor Tufano's out.